Blog Talk Radio.
Technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. The World Transformed is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. We're not here so much to tell you about the future as we are to encourage you to think about your future and to consider what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that will occur in your life, in your world, the one that begins with recognizing and acting on the vast possibilities that are unfolding before you, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Doing great. Doing great. Having a good week. Hope you are as well.
I'm having a very, very productive week. Can't believe it's Wednesday already. Seems like the week just sort of caught up on me. But I'm really excited about our program tonight. And you know what? We've got a surprise guest. Did I even mention our guest in the show notes? I don't believe I did. And since he's graciously agreed to be with us the whole time, I don't know. Is he ready to be called a guest host at this point, Stephen? What do you think?
Well, Paul's been with us before, and he's a fantastic guest, so it's good to have him. So yeah, if you want to, let's go ahead and call him a guest host tonight. That would be great.
Kind of a host trainee, something like that.
I'll actually have to build a trophy shelf.
There you go. This is, of course, Paul Vasquez, Vice President of Singularity Network, with us, and our first order of business this evening, Paul, other than to say welcome to the program and how's it going, it is to get a quick update on last time you were here. You were telling us all about the upcoming Radical Life Extension Conference, which is now the past Life Extension Conference, so how'd it go?
Oh, it was great. It probably went as well as I expected it to. I know that might not sound great, but it actually went a lot better. I think what was probably the best wasn't a swamp room. It wasn't filled to capacity, but who we had there was just fantastic. The speakers, the participants, everyone there had something to give and something to add to the experience. So even some of the people that at some of these conferences you meet who seem a little bit eccentric at times, still were added great value to the conference. And there wasn't a person there who I think was too far off. You always worry that you might find some people who are way far out on the spectrum of. Because we're on the fringe. We're on the fringe, but we're not totally out there.
There's the fringe, and then there's the fringe of the fringe.
We didn't have any of that, but everyone had something positive to bring into the forum. Most of the questions asked to the speakers were very intelligent questions. Most of them were on point. The biggest problem was with the lack of time. The speakers had so much to share, and their topics. prospects were so good. They were like a juicy apple. You know, you got one bite and that was it. And then they had to move on to the next one, and you took a bite of that, and you were like, oh, just a little more, but we just didn't have time to cover everything. So a lot of great speakers.
Well, it sounds like a fantastic event. So, for those who were not able to be there, is there some way of accessing this awesome content?
Sure, we have two ways right now. Well, not right now, but that are in the works right now. One will be a DVD, and the DVD is a special director's cut edition that can be purchased. Now, the only reason we're getting into this whole DVD thing is because we're going to be using some of those proceeds to help fund raising money for life extension research. So we can start to not just, you know, share the information, but use it to help build the research. So it's important that we are going to release a YouTube edition that everybody can watch, but some of the speakers have already said they don't want their talk on the YouTube edition. So on the YouTube edition, there's going to be content that you're not going to be able to get unless you get the DVD. And Steve and I were talking a little bit before the show. DVD, besides helping raise money to help us all live longer, it's a great format for then someone to lend out, someone who might not have access to a computer, to lend out to a friend, to a family member. And all these talks were great. You know, they didn't get too technical, but they were just jam-packed full of good information. I think you're going to miss out. If you're interested at all in living long, healthy, happy life, you're going to miss out if you don't get this information.
Absolutely. Well, I would encourage everyone who's interested in this topic, and I don't know why anyone wouldn't be. We're all interested in it, I mean, in the sense that we all have an interest in it, but everyone needs to take an interest in this. And this is a fantastic opportunity to find out some of the latest thinking on this subject via this DVD. So if you want to see the DVD, where do you go? What do you do? How do you get it?
You can. I did put a link on Singularity Network. There's also a link at My Help, but I'll make sure you get a link too, Phil, and you can put it in.
We'll put it up on worldtransform.com, and I'll put it over on the Speculist as well.
Great. Without giving away too much, Phil, did you get a chance to listen to your five questions?
No, I haven't. I haven't yet.
You haven't?
I still haven't listened to our, and more importantly, the answers to the five questions. But,
I've already started changing the way I live my life based on the information that was at that conference.
Is that right? Based on the answer to my question about what should a person do now, or?
It was kind of a culmination. The thing is, some of the questions you asked were a little bit review of some things that were already said.
Oh, uh-huh.
So you kind of get a little bit of both there. I'll go ahead and give it away what I'm doing. I'm starting intermittent fasting, and it's rough. It's rough, but I'm excited to see the results.
We should do a whole show about intermittent fasting.
Is the idea that you get some of the benefit or most of the benefit of calorie reduction, extreme calorie reduction without having to live such a, it's a little less brutal than extreme calorie reduction? Is that the idea?
Sure. For instance, Wolverine, you know, Hugh Jackman, he used intermittent fasting when he was training for the last Wolverine movie. The Rock, Dwayne Rock Johnson uses it. A lot of bodybuilders are starting to use it. Life extensionists are using it. I'm going more the bodybuilder route. So I'm still maintaining all the calories that I need to in order to live a happy, healthy life. So I'm not doing any real caloric restriction at all. All I'm doing is restricting the times that I'm eating. So yesterday I did a 14-hour, and I think my goal is 16, is to get up to where I'm doing a 16-hour fast, and that includes overnight. You know, you got to eat, you know, 7-8 hours at night.
Yeah, if you can get to sleep, right, it really helps. That gives you a great head start on your fast.
Well, sure, you know, there's, I mean,
it's those waking hours that kill you. Well, that's
you have four to eight more hours either at night or in the morning or you know, split them up.
Exactly. Well, I can't wait to hear the answers to all those questions. And this is a topic we should revisit. Actually, we should. You know what? After we've had a chance to review the material, let's just do kind of a debrief on the whole event here one of these weeks. And so, since it was such a huge success, I assume there's already plans then for a 2014 version of the same event or an expanded version of the same event or something like that?
You know, so far they want three. I've got notice of three different types of conferences that they want me to help out with.
Awesome.
So one, well, I can't talk about them though. I can't talk about them right now.
You'd have to kill us.
Sorry.
You can tell
you
us,
have
but
to
yeah.
Stay tuned to this radio program because they will be announced on this program. So
as soon as we know, folks, we'll tell you.
Stay tuned to upcoming shows.
As soon as Paul can tell us, we'll tell you. All right. That
yep.
sounds great. Well, thank you for that update. That is. That is really exciting stuff. Looking forward to getting that DVD and picking this discussion up. And I don't know, maybe, you know, once we get going, we might do a whole separate show on intermittent fasting because it's a very interesting topic for me. But speaking of interesting topics, we've got a whole show dedicated to the 20,000-year leap, which we're going to get to in just a moment, but I've got an update of my own to give. An update on the world's longest book. Now, last week, Stephen, you weren't here, so you didn't get to hear the good news, unless you were listening. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so then you know that as of last week, we had 16 authors signed up out of the 99 that we required. That was up from the first four, which, of course, are you, me, Ray Kurzweil, and Ramez Nam. So we quadrupled in 1 week. Now, we're slowing down, okay? We could not keep that breakneck pace, but would you care to guess from 16? Or I'll put it to you, Paul, because Stephen, I know you.
I know.
You may have peaked. I bet you don't.
I peaked
because you know what? I've added. Maybe since last time you looked, or maybe not. I don't know. But Paul doesn't know. So Paul, take a guess. We were 16 last week. How many we got?
Anywhere between 47 and 53.
Oh, give me a number. Uh-huh. Come on, anywhere between
47.
No, actually, you're high. Thank you for that vote of confidence. We've got 34 signed up, so we more than doubled our 16, and we're rolling along great here. But I like that enthusiasm. Well, let me tell you who we've got. Oh, I'm not. I feel I'm very pleased at the way the first third. We're more than a third of the way to our 99 for the abridged edition. Very pleased at how quickly we signed those up. Although, in some ways, I feel like we may have gotten the low-hanging fruit. Not to say that that any of these people are easy to get. These are all incredibly busy, incredibly serious people. We heard back from the responsive, you know, ones who immediately we got their attention, and now we're continuing to work the list. Some stragglers are going to come in, and we're gonna look for some other alternative ways of reaching out to people to get that next 66, and we'll be talking about that in upcoming programs. But I feel I should share with everyone the list as it stands. So you heard me read down through Ramez Nam. Here is the rest of the list of authors as it stands right now. Brian Wong, PJ Manny, Michael Darling, Aubrey de Grey, George Dvorsky, James Hughes, Sonia Arison, Tobias Buckel, Jim Elvidge, Nikola Danilov, Alvis Bridges, Natasha Vita Moore, Aurelian Carpathia, Are You Serious?, Dave Goebel, John Smart, Maria Konovalenko, Ben Gertzel, David Pierce, Joseph Jackson, Paul Fernhout, Philip Van Nederveld, Joseph Rampola, Tyler Emerson, Max Marty, Barry Ptolemy, John Cabrera, Eric Lives, David Brin, and Reichert von Wolfshield. You know what, Stephen? Say again, Paul?
This was the low-hanging fruit. I can't imagine who's on the top.
By low-hanging fruit, I don't mean anything about the quality of the people, because obviously these are the top people in the world. These are this is as good as it gets. Well, I'll tell you. Let's be very frank, okay? Let's open the kimono here. one glaring name missing from the list right now. Let's just say it. Paul Vasquez.
In fact,
I've got him listed on my Google Doc as a no currently. So I'm that,
no, it's a yes. It's just going to, you know, it's not going to be a quick, you know, turnaround for me. That's all.
Okay. So wait, you've officially become a yes?
You're the list. Yeah.
35, ladies and gentlemen.
It was
35.
A yes, but, you know, I couldn't get it done tomorrow.
Oh, well,
you
it's
know,
not
it
due
was,
tomorrow.
It was
that's
saying
okay.
it's going to take me some time.
When it's due tomorrow, I'll be on your phone. You don't even have to worry.
Okay.
I'll be at your door, right? I'll be knocking.
Oh, really? Oh, well.
Yeah. Paul.
Well, I'm going to have a party.
Yeah. Where's that chapter?
Everybody,
so, anyway.
Come, come on. Get down.
Yeah. Anyway, that's great, Paul. We're glad to have you aboard, and that makes 35. It's a terrific list of folks we have working on it so far, and I'm looking forward to lining up the next 64 now. Okay, awesome. That's it's getting easier and easier, don't you think, Stephen?
Well, I tell you, we will have authors for this abridged edition. Well, I'm just going to throw out a guess. What do you think? We'll have our 99 authors. What, 2 or 3 weeks? And what do you think?
Yeah. Let's say, what is today? Today is the second. Let's say by Halloween. Okay. By the end of the month,
yeah.
we'll have 99 commitments. I think that's fair because there are a few. The nice thing about the ones we've got so far, here's what makes them low-hanging fruit, okay? We know them, right? They're people who've been on the show, and I don't have to explain who I am to them. That part they've already heard, right? So there's a few that I'm reaching out to.
We don't have to have that awkward, don't you know who I am speech.
Which I have no problem giving. Hey, I do that all the time. But for folks who are like one circle out, if we haven't been introduced to them, I'm going to give it an extra week or two. So let's say we'll have all 99 by the 34th. But here's what I was going to say, Stephen. Do you realize already, just in the 2 weeks we've been working on it, we've got more people lined up to write this book than we ever had on either of our special World Transform series.
Now, should we take this as a good thing, or is it somehow a slight on our ability to get folks for those series? I don't know how we should take that. You know.
I take it as we're getting better at this. That's how I take it.
Oh, okay, Then all right, let's spin it that way.
Yeah, we're improving.
That's great. That's great.
Better all the time. Incremental.
Incremental improvement all the time. Yeah.
All the time. Better all the time. All right. So that's our update for this week. And for those of you listening who are on the list, an email will be going out talking a little bit about some of the formatting and requirements. We're still nailing down what the topic categories will be, but I'll be sharing with those who are authors the broad timeline and word count and some of those kinds of issues. So look for that. And with that, let's move on to the 20,000-year leap. Now, I've got a really interesting experience around setting this thing up. I read this piece. Oh gosh, did I link it at worldtransform.com? I hope I did. I want to get the name of the publication right, so I don't want to misstate. Here we go. This is it. It's learningmind.com, learning-mind.com. And, I'm not logged in the chat. I'll have to get logged in the chat so I can share this link in the chat room. But the headline was, in the 21st century, humanity will move 20,000 years forward. And it starts out at the International Congress in Moscow, Russia. Global Future 2045, renowned scientist and futurist Ray Kurzweil spoke about the future of mankind. And one of his predictions is, in the next century, we will move forward at a rate not 100 years, but 20,000 years, promised Professor Kurzweil. The speed of progress constantly increases. Incredible advances that have been made in just a few years are all around us today. And they begin talking about some of the technologies that entails. Now, this is a very familiar idea for us. On this program, because we've talked about that. This is not a new quote from Kurzweil. I mean, if he does a lot of best of stuff when he gives a talk, and so the 20,000 years in a century idea is something we've heard from Ray before. And in fact, when I talked about this on The Speculist a while back, we talked about it in terms of human evolution and kind of a self-directed approach to evolution. And we compared it with a couple of quotes from some other people who were talking about the future. And one of those was actually Stephen Hawking, who gave a very similar kind of prediction. Actually, it's mathematically it's the same as Kurzweil's, but what he says is we'll progress 10,000 years in 50 years. But if you do the math, right, basically,
right.
They're talking about the same basic rate of change. And then there was a quote from this fellow, I believe his name is Joseph Ratner, who is or at least at that time was the CTO of Intel, Justin Ratner, and he predicted that we would advance 35,000 years in the next 100 years. So one of the things that was interesting to me at the time that I wrote that piece was that not only are you seeing this idea of rapid acceleration becoming more mainstream, coming from someone like Stephen Hawking, this, you know, not someone who's thought of as kind of an outlier or kind of a fringe individual the way some people might look at Kurzweil, but someone who is seen as about as mainstream a scientist as you can have, saying essentially the same thing as Ray Kurzweil. And then to further compound the normalization of singularity type thinking, you've got the idea coming from a major corporate executive of a big company, you know, Justin Ratner. I mean, you might expect a statement like that from somebody at Google, especially these days, but from Intel, that's pretty cool. And he is actually giving a broader, a more ambitious projection of change than Kurzweil, although actually not that much broader, because as we'll get into it, if we look at how much we've changed since 20,000 years ago and how much we've changed since 35,000 years ago, it's probably just almost exactly the same amount. As I think about it, it raises the question: how much did we advance between 35,000 years ago and 20,000 years ago? Stephen, thoughts on that?
Well, you know, in some ways, it depends on how you measure it, doesn't it, Phil? It's you know, if we're talking about our information technology, you know, there was just large periods of time where very very little change took place in information technology. You know, you have the invention of language, I suppose, and then after language, much time passed, and then comes writing, and I guess Gutenberg is probably the next interesting, you know, advance at that point, making writing much more cheap, making it much cheaper to share ideas, and then you know, a whole lot of time passed before you get to the next real interesting thing that took place. So, am I answering your question or am I dodging it with this?
Actually, my question was simpler than that. You're jumping ahead of me.
Okay.
I was just saying, 20,000 years ago we were cavemen. 35,000
right.
years ago we were cavemen.
Roughly, yeah. I mean, if you think about it, and basically until the Industrial Revolution, you know, there's people live very primitively.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, I think, you know, 35,000 years ago was right when we started cave paintings. It was right when we finished off the Neanderthals. But I don't think there was a huge leap of any kind in that whole period. So, in fact, I think maybe Ratner and Kurzweil are saying almost exactly the same thing, which is
right.
that we would experience the level of change from Neolithic living, from Stone Age living, to where we are today. Now go that same distance in terms of how vast a change that is into the future, and that occurs throughout the course of this century. Now, one of the things that was interesting was, I was talking about this with you guys before the show started, was to me this seems like a very familiar idea, and maybe it's because we've talked about it on the program before and we've heard Kurzweil say it, and plus other people are saying it too, but the idea itself seemed to get a lot of pushback. in some of the social media discussion that was going on about that, which I didn't expect to see that, but it did. And there was, you know, what are you saying, that time is going to be compressed, it's going to be slowed down, we're going to speed up, move faster through time? And it's really nothing remotely like that. I don't think that's what Kurzweil is saying. I don't think it's what Stephen Hawking is saying, and I don't think it's what Justin Ratner is saying. No one is saying that time is going to proceed any differently, unless we get, you know, uploaded and suddenly we have a higher clock speed, then subjective time might change. But that's really not what's being suggested. What's being suggested is, as I said earlier, that we will change as much in this next 100-year span as we changed in that prior 20,000 or 35,000 year span. That's the idea. And go ahead.
Let me just jump in. I mean, there's not a lot of evidence to suggest that that we right here, an individual human in this time, is vastly smarter than a human that was one of the first people to settle in cities, right? I mean,
you guys listen to that NPR report? Sorry to jump in.
Yeah.
Did you listen to that?
Yeah, go ahead.
NPR report on a guy who actually studied IQs, and he says if you study IQ tests, it looks like people are getting smarter. He says if you were to take some of the first people to really, you know, start taking IQ tests, they would score 70 on today's
right.
IQ tests, and they would basically be what we would be considered somebody who's has some retardation, some mental retardation. But
right.
But what he found was that, he says, you know, it's not so much that we're smarter, it's just that we have more tools. And so
yep.
And so it's our tools and how we navigate the tools that we have at our disposal that makes us appear more intelligent than some of these earlier people.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about that, and that's the Flynn effect, right? It was Flynn
right.
probably who was on NPR. We talked about this, I don't know, but about a month ago, it seems like we were talking about this really interesting phenomenon of people doing better on IQ tests over the years. Yeah, and it doesn't mean that we have made some brain leap over people from a century ago or even people from 20,000 years ago. You could take a newborn baby from 35,000 years ago and, you know, slip them into a maternity ward at a hospital here, so, you know, swap them out with somebody else's baby, and let them get raised in this world, and I think they'd do just fine, right? So, and you give them an IQ test, and they do okay on it, I believe. Because, you know, 35,000 years even isn't enough time really for anything big genetically to have occurred. It's got to be something it's got to be some conditioning that we're giving ourselves, as you said, Paul, through the technological infrastructure that we've created, and also just through ideas. You know, once a concept is out, it's easy to get it into your head. Before somebody thinks of an idea, it's really hard to come up with it. You know, that's kind of that's kind of the heavy lifting of getting smarter, and we've got people doing that for us now and pulling us all along in a really amazing way. So yeah, a couple of objections to this idea that I bumped into. One is that that innovation is actually slowing down, so we're not going to see this huge shift within 100 years. And one commenter pointed out it's been 40 years since we sent anybody to the moon. And another commenter pointed out that scientific research is growing, but it's not exponential. So there's not going to be enough knowledge produced to push us that far into the future over that short of a period of time. Either one of you two have any thoughts on those objections?
Well, there's a simple answer to this, Phil, and it is this. If we believe that there's nothing we can do in the next, you know, 90 years or so, what's left of this century, to make ourselves smarter, to actually boost our own intelligence, or have AIs that are more intelligent than people. In other words, if we don't reach the singularity in this century, then we're not going to see that kind of advance that Kurzweil is talking about. But if you believe that that's possible, that there will be beings, whether it's us or AIs, that are more intelligent than people, and by a long shot more intelligent, you know, not just, 10% smarter than us, but, 100% smarter or 200%, whatever. If you believe that that is a possibility, then what we're talking about, I think we might be being a little bit conservative saying that we'll see 20,000 years of advance because, how much smarter are we than people that lived 20,000 years ago? I'd suggest not all that much. What we're maybe talking about is a million years worth of advance, maybe more than that. If we see the arrival of greater than human intelligence.
Okay, well let's test that. I like that.
One thing that,
oh, go ahead,
that may
Paul.
May have been overlooked is quantum computing. Is that?
Yeah.
I mean, we've already had a simple quantum computer, if my information is correct, do an equation of 1 + 1 equals 2, right? So. That's very perceptive. If you believe, technology in those areas grow at an exponential rate, having quantum computers, and if my information's wrong, someone needs to tell me. But from my understanding, once you have the basic quantum computer, it can process things back up until its creation. So even if you're 50 years out from that computer, you can use time both in the future and in the past to run your calculations.
Right.
Well, and to put it this way, a good quantum computer will be able to solve problems that a computer running for the entire history of the universe, a traditional computer, could not solve.
Right.
So you talk about 20,000 years of advance, you might be being a tad conservative. If we have quantum computers or if we have greater than human intelligence, And the idea of that is that once we have greater than human intelligence by any means, then those people or beings or whatever you want to call them, part of what they will do is make themselves more smart, even smarter still. So it's sort of we've been depending on nature to make us intelligent up till now. We're about to start making ourselves more intelligent. So.
Yeah, and I think again that's probably an accelerated version of what we're already doing. If you're to believe the Flynn effect, we are in fact making ourselves more intelligent. We're not changing our wiring, but we're changing our capability to execute smartness, which is perhaps every bit as important. So let's talk a little bit about what it means for us to move ahead 20,000 years. Let's talk about what a 20,000-year leap looks like. And to do that, what I suggest we do is let's look at the leap we just took, the one from 20,000 years ago, that let's say we finished in the year 2000, okay? And let's talk about how different are we from the people back then. And then we can see, see if we can make projections forward for what how different people from us will be, based on undergoing the same level of change. So here's the first question. How do we compare to humans of 20,000 years ago biologically? And in fact, we've jumped the gun on this and we've already answered it. Biologically, we're the same species. We're them, they're us, right? You could take one of them, clean them up, dress them up nice, put them on a city bus, and no one would know that that was a human being from 20,000 years ago.
Except he'd probably be really freaked out.
Well, he'd be totally freaked out. But bottom line is, once that individual learned the ropes, I think they'd do okay, right? They could get up to speed on our world, and they could do all right. You could also take a person from this era and drop them back in their time, and that would be much harder, I think. As hard as it would be for the person from 20,000 years ago to assimilate in our world, it would be much harder for one of us to go back and live in that world because that world
sucked.
Mortality
rates were higher.
Yeah. by our standards, that's just a really nasty world to live in terms of everything, hygiene and nutrition and fearing for your life and all those, being cold all the time and just all kinds of wonderful things that would kick in. Unless you take somebody from this time who's already like a hunter-gatherer, they'd do all right. Or I guess if you took like a newborn baby and whisked them back there, they'd grow up and they'd be fine. They'd be a good little caveman. I think that would be a mean thing to do, and I'm not recommending that. If anyone has a time machine, don't do that. But all that's to say, biologically, we're them, they're us. We're all the same. How about socially, right? How does our world compare to their world in terms of social constructs, social infrastructure? Well, back in those days, they had what? They had tribes. They had family units. I assume that people had friendships, as we do today. People operated within their own, you know, clan, their own network. I don't know if this is before any kind of probably very organized trade was going on, so there wasn't much exposure to others outside of probably violent confrontations, that if you ran into another group, that was probably going to be a mess. It was probably going to be a big fight or something like that. So they lived what we would consider to be extremely insular lives around a fairly small group of other people.
You guys remember Prometheus?
Yes.
This last alien movie?
Right.
Yeah.
So when they did the genetic test on the alien, one of the creators, he was human.
But right. He
looked just ginormous and just all decked out, really smart, really muscular. And so if say the genetics were the same, but all that had really changed was their environment, so to speak. And so those beings had kind of reached the pinnacle of who humans could possibly be in that DNA structure. You could almost take a look at that movie as a projection. Just as our brains may be slightly bigger to those of the cavemen because of nutrition. We've mastered nutrition a bit better than they had, and so our brains are a little bit larger on average because, we feed our infants normally, whereas they might have been struggling just to do that. So we have seen, while we're the same genetically, our social systems, our technium allows us to be a more advanced type of human than if we were back then, because of we wouldn't have access to the same tools. So I think that might give us a peek if we maintain our same DNA.
I think so. I think you're right. That we're probably playing out that physical potential better than they did, and not as well as they did. In some cases, it's interesting when you. I've got several other topics listed here after socially. If we talk about medicine, we can talk about diet, right? How do we eat compared to how they ate? Well, something interesting intervened between us and them, which was the agricultural revolution, and there are many folks around today, a lot of whom are interestingly are in the acceleration aware community, the transhumanist or singularitarian community. Who believed that they were eating better back then than the modern diet. So you have this whole movement towards the paleo diet, right? It's saying,
right,
let's emulate them at least to that extent. We probably don't want to readopt their social norms or their social structure. We don't want to renounce all this technology. We don't want to forget all the great things we know or not do as well on IQ tests as we're currently doing. But there are some reasons to believe that maybe in some regards they were eating healthier than we are today. So, in fact, that might be something that we have in common with these remote ancestors of ours.
So I think that genetic variant or that genetic portion of it, we're still going to be affected by protein and by, glucose and those things that really affect, our ability to live, those basic biological things. How we assimilate that has changed over the years, and some people are kind of getting back to that. But once again, we still cook the food. I don't know, if we're talking about a time period pre-fire or not. And also different hygiene issues of cleaning the food, refrigerating the food. These are things that they didn't have access to.
Let me reiterate, just in case there's ever any misunderstanding. Their world sucked, okay? I wouldn't go back there for I mean, but there's nothing you could do that would persuade me to go back, right? Yeah, because even when they cooked it, it was like, yeah, right? I don't think so. You know, big haunch of mammoth over an open flame, you know, seared on the outside, nice and rare on the inside. count me out, okay?
I would like to address the social thing, though. You know,
okay,
20,000 years 20,000 years ago, you had just scattered groups of tribes mostly. What would you guys say? Was it about 10,000 years ago, maybe a little before, that we really started seeing the first true cities of any sort?
Agriculture starts about 12,000 years ago, and then civilization follows quickly afterwards, within a couple thousand years.
Yeah, and it took agriculture to allow people to live together, you know, that way, in order to provide enough food for a large number of people to live in a close proximity to one another.
Right.
That was a prerequisite to cities, was agriculture. Okay, so we got cities, and one of the great things about cities is you've got lots of people bumping into each other, sharing ideas with one another. And one person might have 1% of a great idea, and if you're living as a caveman, you might be the genius caveman surrounded by normally intelligent cavemen, and nothing really comes of your partial idea, right? And so, you know, millions of years go by with not a lot of advance, but advancements began and much quicker once you started seeing cities. I'm going to tell you, we had a 20,000 year sort of advance that we've already lived through, Phil, and that's the beginnings of the internet.
Right.
If you think about it, the 35 people that have committed to help us write this book, in a way, are members of our tribe. We don't live close to one another. We're scattered throughout the world, but we interact with one another. We share ideas. We've spoken with one another. We've written to one another. And yet we're not, we don't have to be close to one another anymore, and it's primarily because of the internet. And so that's a huge advance, and I don't know how you put a particular, how many years does that represent an advancement? Hard to say, but it's so huge that it's sort of one of those things that once it's happened, it's just ho-hum. Except when you really think about it, and how profound a change that is.
And I don't know how many years it is either, but it's towards the end of the 20,000 that the internet shows up. And we should keep, we should bear in mind that we're now well into this, fairly well into this century where the next 20,000 years is going to occur. So you think of the internet as really showing up as a force in our lives, probably about 5 years, 7, 8 years before. The millennium, right? It was early mid 90s for most of us when it became a factor in our lives. But look at how much differently we rely upon it for social interactions today than we did then. And I think, Stephen, you make a really good point. It's the whole notion of tribe has kind of been reintroduced. So it's yet another thing that we sort of have in common with them that maybe we didn't have as much in common with them a while back, but it's a completely different kind of tribe, because it's a tribe purely by self-selection. It's a tribe that we're members of tribes that we've picked, that has nothing to do with family relationships, has nothing to do with geographic location. It has everything to do with ideas. It has everything to do with we all have a common interest in this, therefore we form a tribe around that. And you think about an interaction as, to us, simple as what the three of us are doing right now. This so far transcends anything that could even be imagined by our ancestors. Here we are, any two of us is farther apart from the other. Any one of us is far apart from either of the other two than anyone 20,000 years ago ever traveled in their entire life, almost certainly, right? Nobody ever went that far, probably. Certainly never had a relationship of any note with anybody at that distance, because it was impossible to. And the idea of just casually chatting with someone on the other side of the continent, which we're doing right now, we're having this transcontinental conversation, which potentially is being listened to either live or via recording by people everywhere on the globe, it's simply like we're living in the age of magic and wonder compared to compared to them. We are the sexy immortal billionaires, right? We're the wizard kings to their mundane caveman life. Even if we could find the words in their language to describe what we're doing, they would have a very difficult time conceptualizing it. And so when we talk about social interactions that we'll be engaged in, or that our descendants will be engaged in at the end of this current century, we have to think of it in those kinds of terms. We have to think, well, things that so transcend all the limits that we currently take as a given, that it pushes us to a place that we can scarcely imagine, and maybe can't even imagine, which brings us to the whole notion of the singularity. What's interesting about that is we don't tend to think of there being a lot of limits anymore, do we? We think that, well, I can talk to anybody, just about anybody I want to, and I can have as rich an interaction with them as I would like to have. And it's the fact that we can't even imagine what that next leap is that makes it so difficult to talk about, makes it so difficult to talk about the 20,000-year leap. Except maybe our guest last week gives us a little bit of a hint. Ramez Nam talking about the fictional drug Nexus in his books Nexus and Crux, used by people to connect their minds with each other, and we're rapidly moving in that direction. Here we're having this interchange with each other, tribes formed around ideas, people interacting with each other just strictly around information and ideas. You know, the next step is maybe that the minds cut out all the internet middlemen and just start interacting with each other. Possibly that's one version of where things might be going socially in the future. Another possibility, and this might occur in an intermediate way, is that the technology enables us to build our own little enclave of reality, and a lot of people just escape from normal social interactions and have false social interactions within a very secure and protective environment. Both of those are possibilities. So, in fact, I think it's probably likely that both can and probably will occur. The question is, what will be the predominant model, and what will happen that I'm not even thinking about right now in terms of how people relate to each other socially? But let's jump to the big one. After medicine and diet and morally, I actually believe that morally we are, let me go ahead and be very judgmental here for a moment, superior to our remote ancestors. I think that we're nicer than they were, and I think that we are great big old D-bags compared to the people who will be around at the end of this century. I think that they will look back on us as morally not that great and in need of a lot of cleanup. And I think that's part of the progression that occurs with the big change, which is technology, right? Here's the real way our world is different from theirs, and we'll come back to the moral thing in just a minute. But the real way our world is different from theirs is that they didn't have it, and we do, right? What they had was sharp rocks. Maybe you could even attach a handle to it. They had perhaps figured out how to light a fire, and maybe they had figured out how to, cure an animal skin and put it on and stay warm. Contrast that with what we have going on technologically, and you see the vastness of the difference between the two worlds. What were you going to say, Stephen?
Well, I was just going to say we tend to be as nice as we can afford to be, and
right.
That sounds very cynical, but I don't mean it to be that way at all. We did terrible things to one another, and in part because we felt like we, to get ahead in this world, we had to take it from someone else. We have found, particularly as we've advanced in technology, is that we get so much more from cooperation than we do from the zero sum game of warfare. We make greater advances at much less personal cost than warfare, and so it's not that we're you know, I would suggest to you again, if you brought forward the caveman and as particularly as a baby and raised him in our society, I think he'd be just as smart. I think he'd also be just as nice.
Of course, yeah.
You know,
yeah, it's no credit to us. It's no credit to us as individuals that we're nicer. If being bigger D-bags was more effective, then that's what we would be, right? But it looks like, from an evolutionary standpoint, being nicer is actually the thing that that moves us forward, and so that's the direction we've moved in. What do you think about that, Paul? Would you agree with that?
Well, I'm thinking back to Prometheus here. If I had to happen to be raised by a Promethean, you know, I'd be super smart, super big, but I'd be okay with destroying, you know, my genetic offspring, you know, on Earth, who I decided it wasn't worth keeping around. So, I mean, that was kind of a D-bag move still, you know?
It was.
So,
luckily,
you
know that's not a documentary,
that's
right?
Not,
you know that.
That's not the guy.
Go ahead, Steven.
I was just going to say there are ways in which we can make ourselves better people. Vegetarians have long suggested to us that that we can be better people by not killing our animal neighbors for food. And
right.
I would suggest to you that the technology is going to allow us to make that move, to be more ethical. Regarding animals, to be more humane, and still get the protein we need, and so you know we'll be able to eat all the steaks we want without a single cow dying, that sort of thing. You know, that's again, it's technology allowing us to take a step ethically that we're just not ready to take if we don't have that technology. So,
I think we've talked about it
before.
If you look at the U.S. Civil War, it's between the industrial North, where they've got machines and they don't need slaves, and the agrarian South, where they had an economy still relying on slaves. So if you get to the next evolutionary level technologically and economically, you can take the more high-minded position. Slavery is wrong. A lot of people in the South also took the position that slavery is wrong. It's not to say that it was just this purely cut and dried everyone. Acting in their in their most base self-interest, and a lot of people, as odd as it might sound, I guess sincerely believed in slavery, whatever that means. But but the bottom line is, there was a time not that long before the U.S. Civil War when most of the people on Earth were, in some sense or another, the property of some other human being, and that idea has mostly been eliminated. It's still going on, sadly, in a few pockets of the world. But that idea, we got rid of that idea. Why did we get rid of that idea? Well, I think in part because we were able to get things done without enslaving each other. I think that's a big piece of it. That what worked economically and what worked socially and what worked from a standpoint of propelling us ahead technologically, those three things lined up. It seems to me that they've lined up pretty well throughout history. And so, Paul, I would say by the time we're the advanced Promethean-type people, we're going to be really nice. We would not kill our progeny,
I think there are some things which could hint the other way, and that's things like the atomic bomb. I mean, the ability we have to destroy ourselves on a much larger scale is something we have now that our cavemen didn't. So this technium has also granted us the ability to be far worse than them, and we've had to learn to constrain ourselves as humanity, and not take advantage of the fact that we do have the ability now, and some have used it. Right, it has been used.
It has been used.
These weapons of mass destruction, and there are currently nations out there which do seek the ability to use these weapons for gain, either politically or otherwise, and that may still be a challenge for us, is to try to as our ability grows to be nicer, our ability to be just as bad may grow, and that may hopefully drive us to be better stewards of the power that we do have.
Oh, I agree. I, you know, technology, one of the things it does is it vastly increases our capacity to do harm, our capability to do damage. Luckily, I think that we're gaining that capacity. At the same time, we're gaining a tendency not to be so evil. I'll tell you what, I wouldn't want to introduce nukes into, say, medieval Europe, okay? I think that that would have been a very bad thing. If they'd have had them, they would have used them with a lot less discretion than they're currently being deployed. And that's not to suggest that there aren't some really evil people today who would love to get their hands on terrible capability and do terrible things with it. But on balance, I think it speaks pretty well for us that we've had that capability for 70 years now, and we're still here. We haven't wiped ourselves.
Knocked on some wood here.
Yeah.
On wood, yes, definitely.
For whatever reason, we've used it in a way that hasn't wiped us out, and I feel pretty good about that. Now, there's one other aspect to technology that I'm going to get to here in these final few minutes, and that is, you know, everything we've talked about up to this point, up to and including the atomic bomb, is all about mastery of the physical world, you know. So back then, their mastery of the physical world included fire and basic tools and, like I said, you know, buckskins and things like that. And here today, we've got cars and skyscrapers and electrical infrastructure and big dams and windmills and factories and airplanes and trains and rockets and ships and 3D printers and just everything you can imagine that would just blow the socks off a caveman who doesn't even have socks.
Right.
But what's even bigger than that is our mastery of information and the role that information has come to play, the role that knowledge has come to play in driving our civilization and driving where we're going. They had what? Spoken language, whatever could be remembered, whatever could be passed down from generation to generation. And by then, they were doing cave paintings. And as far as we know, that's it, right? They were making a few etchings here and there, and they were talking to each other. Versus, Stephen, you already mentioned it, the Internet, right? This massive explosion of capability to share information, to store and share information in ways that were never possible before. Stephen, as you mentioned, Gutenberg was this huge step in the right direction. Written language was this huge step in the right direction. As soon as we could write things down, knowledge could be passed on generationally. As soon as we could mass distribute it, it could grow rapidly, and it could be shared at a much lower cost. But when you get to the age of the computer, and then when you go from there to the age of the networked computer, and you get to the age of the Internet, when we're basically using information to increasingly connect ourselves and increasingly drive what we think of as the world, it's almost like, although we said biologically we're the same as them, it's almost like we are completely different species from those folks, because we're really, in a sense, a hybrid of the biological organism, which is the same as them, and the technological organism, which is sort of what we've become. Stephen, when you talk about how you think of Google as being part of your brain, well, I mean, you know, that's not just a joke. You really do use Google as part of your brain. And our cars are like, you know, part of our ability to get around. All of the technology that we have has moved us so far beyond what they experienced and how they interacted with the world, and in particular information technology, and that in particular social technology, beyond even that. So if we're going to project ahead to that next 20,000 years, once again I'm left at a point of complete impasse. I can't project it because it's really hard to imagine how far things might actually go.
It is. I mean, and I would suggest that a lot of this is going to be an increasingly intimate connection between people. And at the same time, people themselves are going to get smarter by one means or another. And I'm saying people broadly to include AGI. So
that's right.
Yeah.
And who knows? 100 years from now, or 87 years from now, at the end of the century, we might be looking at something more like, you know, an entire new life form, a whole human mechanical organism that covers the entire planet and that is reaching out into space, just a a being or set of beings, because maybe even those categories don't make sense. They only make sense from our standpoint. They won't make any sense at all to people in that age. Thinking thoughts that we can't imagine, doing things that we can't imagine. And I guess ultimately that's what the singularity is all about, a future that we just plain can't quite picture. So with that, I guess, oh gosh, we're right at the end of our time. Stephen, what's our music?
Our music tonight is Only the Good Things by Willie 14.
Perfect. Only the Good Things by Willie 14. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Paul, what a great pleasure to have you with us. Come back and talk with us again soon, won't you?
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right. We will be back at the regular time next week. Hope you'll all be with us. Thanks for being part of The World Transformed. And until next time, live to see it.
Good thing.